Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. Whether you are a student prepping for tests and boards or a CRNA here to earn CEUs, we are glad you've joined us. For more about us, make sure to check us out on Instagram at Core Anesthesia and online at coreanesthesia.com.
Welcome back to Core Anesthesia. I'm Cole, here with Tanner, and today we want to do a discussion looking at hypotension and shock. And this is something that in the realm of anesthesia, most of the interventions that we're going to do on a day-to-day basis with almost every procedure that we're administering anesthesia is going to cause some level of a drop in blood pressure. And so today we're going to walk through, first of all, what is hypotension? What are some of the things that we would do typically that we would see on a day-to-day basis and how we would intervene and manage that? But most of the talk then is going to focus on when you have severe hypotension, specifically when you have shock and the different forms of shock. What are the signs and symptoms of those, the causes of those, and depending on which cause is causing that shock to occur, what our treatment or interventions are going to be. So that's kind of the flow that we're going to do today. So Tanner, do you just want to start us off with a basic overview of hypotension in general before we get into shock?
So first of all, when we're talking about hypotension, why do we care about this? And if you're listening to this, I would assume that either you are preparing for CRNA school, you're in CRNA school, or you are CRNA yourself. So all three of those things, you already have a pretty good handle on why we're concerned about hypotension. But it's important that we start with the basics, kind of talk through some of these things as then we get into more of the meat of the discussion. This will come more into play. But hypotension, we are concerned about this mainly because of perfusion to our organ systems. And so you can have issues with perfusion to the heart, to the brain, kidneys, liver, all these things that we're concerned about with lasting effects after the hypotension during the procedure. And so intraoperative hypotension can be defined as a mean arterial pressure of lower than 55 to 65. It really depends on the patient's blood pressure and their baseline blood pressure and their other risk factors as well, though there's other factors that will play into that. It's not just as clear cut as just knowing a specific number. Typically, we think you should keep the patient's blood pressure within about 20% of their baseline blood pressure, and because that's where your body is used to living. And so we want to try to avoid some significant swings from their traditional or their typical blood pressure that their organs are used to, you know, having perfusion at. The other thing that we need to keep in mind is how frequently we are even checking blood pressures. Everybody kind of has their own preference of how often they are going to be cycling the pressure. It has to be a minimum of every 5 minutes. Hypotension for more than 10 minutes is associated with a higher risk of postoperative cardiac events. And so the standard there is every 5 minutes at least to be monitoring a patient's blood pressure. Today, I was doing a carotid, and whenever I have an A-line, I always change my blood pressure cuff so it's not cycling quite as much. And it was like a moment where I looked up and I was doing some charting. I looked up and I just saw the, you know, every 30 minutes on my blood pressure cuff. And I was like, you just have this like slight moment where you're like, oh no, you know, that like there's no way that I accidentally said, and you know, like, remember, like, obviously I have an art line and I'm paying attention to those other things, but just like the brief moment when you look up and you're so used to seeing 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it is, but it just like is ingrained into you that you're checking that blood pressure. And oftentimes, you know, I feel like that's a great time to be checking all of your monitors. You hear your blood pressure going off, you look and you're just checking over all your vitals. But anyways, all to say every 5 minutes at least is the minimum there for checking our blood pressures. When we talk about hypotension, there's some things that you need to think about as far as, you know, why this is occurring. Pretty standardly, our anesthetics are going to cause hypotension, vasodilation. And so that's one of the big reasons that we'll see hypotension during a routine procedure. You can also have issues with hypovolemia. You have these patients that are fasting and they're coming in, if say it's a late in the day case, and these patients, you know, were sleeping all night and then they came in and they have their NPO status and it gets to be late in the day, you can see hypotension from hypovolemia. I think of this specifically if you're doing a laparoscopic case where you're going to have a pneumoperitoneum. It's late in the day. They're already fluid depleted. And sometimes you can see that really profound hypotension because of that hypovolemia. I think, you know, oftentimes we think that is associated with shock and sepsis. And we'll talk about this here in a little bit, but really it can be just as simple as their NPO time as well. Blood loss, that's going to play into our hypovolemia picture. Positioning, that's a huge one. If you have these patients sitting in beach chair, you need to think about how the perfusion is going to be at the brain, not just at wherever the cuff is. And then, you know, like I mentioned with our drugs, that we have hypotension related to our inhaled gases. We have hypotension related to our IV anesthetics. We have hypotension related to analgesics for using narcotics. So there's a lot of times that you have perfectly healthy patients and you can be encountering some hypotension during a case. And that's simply because of all the anesthetics that we're giving these patients. One of the things I wanted to just touch on here, when we're talking about hypotension, is specifically when we're talking about, a lot of times we talk about like the valley of the prep between incision and when we have induced the patient. And a lot of times this is when we're seeing a patient become hypotensive simply because we have anesthetic on board, but we don't have any stimulation going yet. And so this is really just something I want to touch on here, where this is like the first probably main time that you're going to be considering how you're going to manage hypotension in a case, aside from, you know, when you're going to sleep and you're doing your induction sequence. There's also, obviously, I just mentioned hypotensive related events related to the anesthetic drugs that we're giving. So you can see that with induction, but kind of pairing with that when they're prepping and before the incision is made and before their stimulation, there's also this time that we need to be very vigilant to make sure that we are maintaining our patient's hemodynamics.
So let's say you're in a case and you notice the patient's blood pressure has dropped below that 20% baseline, or maybe you have an absolute value number that you're trying to keep either their MAP or the systolic blood pressure above. Whatever the case may be, once you get below that threshold where you're wanting to treat it, what are some of the interventions that we would do as first-line interventions to bring that back up? And as Tanner mentioned, the valley of the prep is one of the main events or the timing of procedures in which we usually see that first hypotension develop. And it's, again, after you've initiated your anesthetic, you've caused that drop in blood pressure to begin, and there's not that surgical stimulation to bring that back up yet. And this is a lot of times where we have to first intervene. And so the treatment plan that you're going to do is ultimately going to vary from patient to patient, as it should. It should be an individualized case-by-case basis, and it's going to depend on the patient's vital signs and their medical history. So typically, the first-line treatment is going to include giving crystalloid, and then potentially medications of either phenylephrine or ephedrine. Those are usually the two first-line medications that we see given in the anesthetic world for treating hypotension. Now, the gold standard to determine if the patient is intravascularly volume responsive or not, if we should err on the side of giving crystalloid or if we should err on the side of pharmacological intervention, that the gold standard to determine whether they're going to be intravascularly volume responsive is going to be using a TEE or a transesophageal echocardiography. And again, this is not going to be very practical, though, in every anesthetic. If you're doing an open heart procedure, you're going to be doing a TEE anyway, and that is very beneficial in that standpoint to determine if the patient needs more volume in the heart or not. But for most surgical procedures that we're doing anesthetic for, you're not going to have a TEE involved. So as a result, another thing that we can look at is systolic pressure variation, pulse pressure variation, or stroke volume variation. So for systolic pressure variation, this is done if you have an invasive arterial line and if the patient is on a positive pressure ventilation. So this is not going to be if you have a patient with an arterial line and they're breathing spontaneously during a MAC anesthetic. But if they are having positive pressure ventilation and you have an ART line placed, then what this method does is it looks at a decrease in systolic blood pressure with each positive pressure breath. So there's a temporary decrease there after each positive pressure breath. And this change in the systolic pressure can be seen visually. If you're watching your monitor across the screen, you'll see the pleth on that arterial waveform dip and come back up and basically a trend, not simply beat to beat, but over several beats. You'll see this drop and then slowly rise again, then drop and slowly rise with each positive pressure ventilation. And that decrease in systolic pressure, if it's greater than 10 millimeters of mercury, then the patient is likely to respond to IV fluid bolus. But again, if you're going to use this method, you have to make sure that the patient has a regular heart rate and a normal PEEP value in order to use this measurement appropriately. Otherwise, these two things, if you don't have a regular heartbeat, obviously you're going to have a change in systolic blood pressure from beat to beat. And the same thing with PEEP, an elevated PEEP will alter that positive pressure as well. The next thing you can use that I mentioned is pulse pressure variation. And this concept is the exact same, but we calculate the pulse pressure and then divide it by the average pulse pressure and then express this answer as a percentage. And this is something that most monitoring devices, if you have an arterial waveform, you can select this option underneath that arterial waveform and it'll calculate it for you. And this gives us a better idea over time of the alteration in blood pressure. And if the resulting number is greater than a 15% change, then this is indicative of fluid responsiveness. So you're going to want to give crystalloid here. And the other one I mentioned was stroke volume variation. And it's the same as that concept, but the computer calculates an estimated stroke volume from that arterial waveform. And then it determines the change in the stroke volume with each breath. And again, greater than 15% change will indicate fluid responsiveness, but you need, again, normal heart rate and normal PEEP values in order to use this calculation. So that is how we determine if the patient mathematically shows that they're going to be fluid responsive. There are other things that different providers will use, but the choice between which pharmacological treatment of phenylephrine or ephedrine is typically dependent on the patient's heart rate. It is usually one of the primary reasons I see different anesthetists determine which one they're going to use. As phenylephrine is going to have a baroreceptor reflex due to the vasoconstriction from the alpha-1 stimulation, it's going to lower the heart rate then. You're going to see that the baroreceptor reflex caused that drop in heart rate as the blood pressure goes up. Whereas ephedrine is going to cause an increase in blood pressure through vasoconstriction, but it also causes the body's natural catecholamine stores to be released, which then will cause an increase in heart rate as well. So a lot of anesthetists will look at the patient's baseline heart rate and determine if the patient's heart rate is below a certain threshold for them, they may more lean towards doing ephedrine versus phenylephrine. And there's no hard, fast rule on if the patient's below a certain value on their heart rate, you have to give one or the other. This is typically an individualized basis, a case-by-case basis. Usually those are the two primary things that we will start with for interventions to treat hypotension in the typical surgical procedure when the patient's under anesthesia. We'll give them a fluid bolus if we think they're going to be fluid responsive, and we'll give them either a phenylephrine or ephedrine. If you want more information on other vasopressor medications that we would do as a next step, we have a whole cardiac medications episode where we go through all the details of further interventions that you would do to boost up blood pressure. But for now, we want to now turn our attention into shock. So there are different forms of shock, as we alluded to earlier, and depending on what the form or the cause is of the shock is going to depend on how you treat it. So it's very important that we are critically thinking when a patient does get into a shock-like picture in terms of trying to figure out what is the root cause, because that will dramatically change how you treat it.
I think oftentimes when we think about shock, we just think, oh, this is just profound hypotension, which is leading to shock. And that could be true. Shock is more than just hypotension. So we need to think about really the basic definition of shock is the inability to deliver oxygen to the critical organs, the different tissues, and maintain the sufficient function that these organ systems, you know, are meant to do. And so when we can't deliver enough oxygen to these tissues, to these organs, we need to start thinking about, like Cole mentioned, there's different reasons that we can be seeing this shock picture. So we need to think about, okay, why is the oxygen not able to be delivered to these tissues? And then subsequently, we're thinking about how can we fix this situation, whatever the, you know, the root cause of it, whatever the root cause of the different types of shock, how can we restore oxygen delivery to the tissues? That's what we're thinking about in a timely manner. How can we make that happen? So when we're talking about the different types of shock, the main ones that we want to talk about, hypovolemic, cardiogenic, you can have cardiac compressive, septic, neurogenic, and anaphylactic shock as well. So let's start with hypovolemic. This is going to result in shock due to a lack of sufficient blood volume that is pumping through the heart. Think about when you have a drop of volume that's returning to the right side of the heart, you're going to have a decrease in preload. And then the decrease in preload is going to lead to a decrease in cardiac output. Often this will occur with large volume shifts. So if you have bleeding from trauma or you have significant intraoperative blood loss during a procedure, these are going to be things that are going to lead to the hypovolemia and then lead to this hypovolemic shock. You can also see significant diarrhea and vomiting can also lead toward hypovolemic shock as well. It's going to be a little bit slower process than when we think about massive fluid shifts from, you know, again, like a trauma bleeding or from intraoperative blood loss. Initially, our bodies are going to try to compensate for the lower blood volume by initiating our renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, our RAS system, and that's going to pull interstitial fluid into the bloodstream, and we're going to try to conserve the fluid volume there. Heart rate is also going to increase because of our baroreceptor reflex, but remember that this can only last so long and be so effective. Our body is going to be releasing catecholamines that will constrict the blood vessels to non-vital organs in order to increase your blood flow to the vital organs. And all this is going to work in concert to ideally be still delivering oxygen to those very important necessary organs. And remember, our whole goal here is we have an issue with oxygen that is being delivered to these organs. How do we reverse that? And how do we get back to a state where we have oxygen delivery? We talk about signs and symptoms of hypovolemic shock. You'll see a decreased cardiac output. We already mentioned that you're going to have a decreased return to the heart, decreased preload, and that's going to lead to a decreased cardiac output. You'll see an increase in systemic vascular resistance, and that's going to be mainly because of those catecholamines that are released. You'll have a decrease in central venous pressure. This makes sense because you have a decreased amount of volume that's coming back to the heart. You'll have a decreased pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, and you'll have a decreased mixed venous oxygen saturation as well. Typically, you'll see cold, clammy skin from that vasoconstriction to those smaller vessels. And again, this is all part of trying to limit the amount of damage to these vital organs by vasoconstricting the blood flow to other non-essential organs to try to keep that volume where it's needed most. When we think about treatment, initially we need to think about replacing the intravascular volume. So we're trying to resuscitate the volume status. Large bore IVs or central venous catheters are, you know, our best friend in this situation where we can give lots of volume quickly. If you have an active hemorrhage, then you need to be giving colloids and blood products such as packed cells, FFP, platelets. You can give those on a ratio of 1:1:1. Many times, depending on, you know, we're talking about shock here, we're talking about massive bleeding, it's important to initiate your mass transfusion protocol and get all hands on deck as far as getting these patients volume resuscitated. Remember that whenever you're giving large amounts of packed cells, we need to remember to keep replacing our calcium and keep a close eye on that. We also are going to be fixated on trying to keep the patient normothermic as well. You're giving lots and lots of volume and fluid here, so it's very important to maintain an adequate temperature on the patient as well. Let's talk about a little bit different situation. If you have a patient that's hypovolemic, but you don't really have active bleeding or a low hemoglobin count, replacement should be started with isotonic crystalloids. So start with lactated ringers or plasmolite. You should avoid normal saline for large quantities because of the risk for hypokalemic metabolic acidosis. So lactated ringers or plasmolite are going to be your first line there. You can also give vasopressors to maintain the hemodynamic stability, but this really should only be a temporary stabilization because the underlying issue is going to be the adequate fluid resuscitation. You can shrink the tank, you know, down with your different vasopressors and increase the perfusion and increase the blood pressure, but the underlying issue is going to be the fluid resuscitation. That's where our focus needs to be. So again, if we have someone that is hypovolemic, but we don't have active bleeding, then start with isotonic crystalloids, again, LR or plasmolite.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by Nurse Anesthesia of Maine, where excellence meets compassion. Established in 2003, Nurse Anesthesia of Maine has grown into a dynamic team of 30-plus CRNAs, serving 12 hospitals and ASCs with exceptional anesthesia services. Nurse Anesthesia of Maine is seeking qualified nurse anesthesiologists to join their outstanding team with competitive salaries, a robust benefit package, flexible schedules, and a commitment to community involvement. Explore Bangor, Maine, a vibrant city surrounded by stunning outdoor landscapes, with all the city conveniences yet within range of both mountain hikes and a beautiful Atlantic coast. It's perfect for work and family life. Elevate your career with Nurse Anesthesia of Maine. Visit www.namecrna.com for more information. That's www.namecrna.com. So next, let's look at cardiogenic shock. And this is going to be a completely different form of causing a deficiency in oxygen to the tissue. So a different form of shock. And because of that, we're going to treat it differently. So cardiogenic shock is the inability to adequately supply oxygen to the tissues. So the definition of shock, but it's as a result from the inability of the heart to either fill with volume or maintain a effective stroke volume. So different causes of this include diastolic or systolic heart failure, myocardial infarction, arrhythmias, valve ruptures, a severe cardiomyopathy, myocarditis. If you have a ventricular septal defect, these are just to name a few of them. But anything that's going to prevent that heart from either filling appropriately or effectively having an adequate stroke volume is going to cause a drop in that oxygen to the tissues. And so signs and symptoms of this, depending on whether it's going to be an acute change to the heart or a slow chronic disease that now has finally reached the end of the body's ability to compensate, either one of those set of things could be causing this. And depending on which form is the cause, the signs and symptoms will obviously differ. And specifically, let's talk about the signs and symptoms if the left side is failing versus the right side. And this is something that most likely we all learned in our undergraduate nursing classes, but if your left side fails, the left side of the heart fails, it's going to result in a backup of blood, which is going to move back into the pulmonary circuit and then cause pulmonary edema and a decreased cardiac output from the left ventricle. And eventually, if it continues to be severe long enough, that blood could back up all the way towards the right side of the heart and increase the pulmonary resistance that the right side of the heart is trying to push blood out against, and eventually cause right-sided failure. So right-sided failure can be a result from the left side, or it can be in isolation by itself. And right-sided failure will result in a backup of blood now going back into the venous circulation. So this is going to show as distended neck veins, peripheral edema is going to develop, hepatic vascular congestion is going to occur. So just think wherever the problem is at, just go backwards in the flow, and that is where you're going to see your signs and symptoms develop. So treatment for this is going to depend on the exact cause, but we should focus ideally, regardless of the cause, on improving the cardiac output. That's the main goal. We should decrease the cardiac filling pressures, and we want to gain a balance between the myocardial oxygen supply and the demand. Because again, remember, every time the heart is beating, it's using up oxygen from the myocardial tissues. So we don't want to increase the workload too much of the heart, because that increases the demand of oxygen needed for those tissues. But at the same time, we got to also make sure we're supplying enough oxygen to those myocardial tissues. So you want to have a balance there of getting oxygen to those tissues, but not having as high of a demand on them. So dobutamine is typically the first line inotrope that is going to be used to treat our cardiogenic shock. And this is because dobutamine is going to increase the cardiac output. It's a direct inotrope on the heart. It can also cause some vasodilation, so keep that in mind. That is a nice thing because it is going to decrease the afterload of what the heart's going to have to pump against. But again, we're increasing the cardiac output by increasing the anatropic effect of the contractility of the heart cells and tissues themselves. Now, if the patient is still hypotensive after we've started dobutamine, again, it can cause some vasodilation, and we can fix that then if the patient's still hypotensive by adding norepinephrine. That's usually the second line that we would add. And this helps combat that dilatory effects of the dobutamine, and it also increases in the blood pressure. Now, if the patient is hypertensive after the dobutamine is started, then typically we'll do nitroglycerin or nitroprusside. It can be used to decrease the afterload and the preload to combat that increase in blood pressure. Now, if the patient is fluid overloaded, in this case, diuresis is going to be needed. So if the patient has too much fluid, there's just too much trying to go through the pump of the heart, the heart's getting backed up with fluid, we're going to treat him by giving a diuretic. If the cause is the right-sided heart failure, if the right-sided heart failure is noted, then interventions are going to be made to decrease any pulmonary hypertension because we don't want any increased resistance or afterload to the right side of the heart. So things that we can do to limit the pulmonary hypertension is going to be making sure that they have enough blood oxygen content and a normal CO2 level. So you want to limit any type of hypoxia or hypercarbia. So under anesthesia, basically that means that we need to be ensuring that we're adequately ventilating and oxygenating the patient. We can also use inhaled nitric oxide. This is really good for pulmonary vasodilation. Typically, we give this in open heart procedures if the patient has that elevated pulmonary pressures. We'll give inhaled nitric oxide to reduce that afterload for the right side of the heart. Now, if the cause here is that the patient is having a MI, then the goal obviously is to restore vascularization to the tissues of the heart through angiography, fibrinolytic therapy, get them to cath lab, to get a stent placed, whatever the case may be to restore that blood flow. And then if the cause is an arrhythmia, then obviously the rhythm should be treated and give any type of pharmacological treatment to correct that arrhythmia, depending on which arrhythmia it is. So in summary with all this, if the initial treatment interventions, depending on exactly what is the cause, if they are unsuccessful, the next step that you're going to do after any of those that I listed, depending on the cause, the next step would be a intra-aortic balloon pump or intra-aortic balloon pump. And that's placed in the aorta and it's inflated during diastole and then it deflates during systole. And this is to augment the diastolic systolic pressure. Again, remember how I mentioned we need to make sure we're supplying oxygen to the tissues of the heart? Well, when the heart is at rest, when it's filling, is when the blood from the aorta fills in through the coronary arteries and oxygen gets supplied to the myocardium. And so that balloon pump, by increasing during that relaxation period, will push more blood into the coronary arteries because it has an increased diastolic blood pressure. And then you get more oxygen to those tissues. At the same time, then it deflates during systole, which kind of helps decrease that afterload and bring more blood out of the heart during systole. And then lastly, if that doesn't correct the problem, or at least maintain enough oxygenation to the tissues, the next step would be to put the patient on ECMO, which stands for extra corporeal membrane oxygenation. And this is reserved for severely damaged hearts in which the deoxygenated blood is going to be removed from a large vein. It's going to be oxygenated and pumped back into either a large artery or a large vein, depending on if both the heart and lungs need to be functionally replaced. So those are kind of the different steps that we'd go through. And I know that's a lot of cardiac just to talk about there. And I had to skim over a lot of broad topics, but that's basically the different causes of cardiogenic shock and what our rough treatment plan would be depending on what the cause is for that decreased ability of the heart to function properly.
Next, let's dive into obstructive shock or cardiac compressive shock. This is going to occur when there's actually a physical obstruction to the flow of blood that's either in the heart or in the main blood vessels. Typically, we think of obstructive shock to include either massive pulmonary embolism, you can have pericardial tamponade, tension pneumothorax, or just a couple of the main things that we think of when we're talking about obstructive shock. The obstruction here will cause a decreased stroke volume, cardiac output, which is not that different from cardiogenic shock. The body is going to respond here by increasing SVR and also your heart rate. The decreased blood flow will cause a backup of blood, and you'll see that with your jugular vein distension. You'll see increased CVP pressures. You can also see hepatomegaly. Think about this is not moving forward. This is going to cause this congestion behind where this issue is. Treatment is going to be finding this specific cause as well as trying to figure out how to increase your cardiac output. So typically you'll get an ultrasound of the thoracic cavity and try to get an idea of the different diagnoses of the obstruction. With a pulmonary embolism, you're going to be treating this with fibrinolytic therapy, pericardial tamponade, you'll do a pericardiocentesis, tension pneumothorax, you're going to place an emergent needle thoracostomy and a chest tube to decrease that pressure. Main thing I want to drive home here is that when we're talking about this type of shock, this obstructive shock, we have a obstruction that is causing issues with positive or forward flow of the blood. And so we have to figure out how are we going to optimize the cardiac output. And ultimately what we need to do is find the problem that is causing this issue. So if that's a PE or if that's an issue with a pneumothorax, you're going to need to find those issues and ultimately have treatment for those issues to improve the blood flow and ultimately fix the issue there of shock. So while this is not cardiogenic where you have necessarily a sick heart, this is not hypovolemic. It kind of ties in some of those same principles as we're talking about. Ultimately, we're having a lack of oxygen being delivered to the tissues. In this scenario, we need to find the root cause and solve that so that the obstruction is identified and fixed. Next category of shock that we talk about is distributive shock. This is going to be a profound dilation of the arterial vascular system, which you'll see a drop in systemic vascular resistance, SVR as well. And your blood pressure obviously is going to be reduced. The three types that we think about here is septic, neurogenic, and anaphylactic when we talk about the distributive shock. So first, septic shock is going to be the body's altered response to an infection. So the glycocalyx is the lining of the capillaries that will become damaged and fluid will be able to leak out of the capillaries. There's no really like definitive treatment to treat sepsis. And we talked about obstructive shock here just a second ago. That's a very cut and dry solution to a problem. Once you've identified the problem, now you can figure out ways to treat that. I'm not saying it's cut and dry as in easy, but there's a very specific cause that we can hopefully fix. And then that is going to allow blood flow to move as it should. With this, there's no real definitive treatment for sepsis because you're going to, you know, have the infection that is causing this issue. So instead, we have a collection of different goals that we're trying to accomplish. And all of these combined is going to be our best chance at treating the patient here with a septic shock. First thing we want to think about is rapid IV fluid resuscitation. So at minimum, we want 30 mils per kilo within the first 3 hours. If we're going to keep fluid resuscitating the patient, you're going to want to do that dependent on the patient's vital signs. You're going to look at their urine output, and then you're also going to be looking at their lactate level as well to see if that's normalized. That first part, we're talking about the rapid fluid resuscitation. Our goal there is 30 mils per kilo. And again, that's within the first 3 hours if we can. Blood cultures should be taken immediately, and we should make sure to take this before we are treating with any broad spectrum antibiotics. And this is very important when we're trying to identify the type of infection here that's causing the issue. This should ideally be done within the first hour of the sepsis diagnosis. After we've tried to fluid resuscitate with that 30 mil per kilo, we should also be thinking about vasopressor use. And this is ideally, again, after we have tried to fill the tank, so to speak, with that fluid resuscitation. Levofed, norepinephrine is considered the first line and followed by vasopressin and then epinephrine if needed for our vasopressor support. We should also be thinking, you know, if the patient also has issues with their hemoglobin levels, we're going to want to transfuse if their hemoglobin is less than 7. And so keep that in mind too, as we're trying to stabilize this patient, that you're also looking, you know, if there's any issues there with their blood levels as well.
So next, we want to jump into neurogenic shock. And the last two, really, we're going to talk about are neurogenic and anaphylactic shock. And both of these, as Tanner mentioned, fall under distributive as well as septic, which you just talked about. So again, just to remind you, all three of these, they cause a profound dilation of the arterial vascular system. So you have a dramatic drop in your SVR, fluid leaks out, and you end up having a drop in blood pressure because of that. So neurogenically speaking, why would this cause this? So we typically will see this result after a traumatic injury to the brain or spinal cord has occurred in the immediate context. And so this is going to result in a decrease in signals, neurologic signals, being sent through the sympathetic nervous system to the periphery, but we still allow parasympathetic signal through. So now you have a blocked sympathetic, and you have the parasympathetic just being able to act completely without any compensation from the sympathetic side. So this is going to result in a decreased SVR because the sympathetic nervous system typically would cause the vasoconstriction, but we don't get that now. And so you have vasodilation, you have pooling of blood in the capillary networks in the periphery, and you have this decrease in systemic vascular resistance. Now, if the injury occurs above the T4 vertebrae, so the thoracic 4 level, this additionally can cause the blockage of the signal to the cardiac accelerator fibers, which are then going to cause bradycardia as well. So if you have that injury above T4, just know that you're also probably going to have bradycardia as a result. So the treatment for this is in the first week after the spinal cord injury has occurred. It's very important to avoid hypotension to prevent any secondary ischemic injury to the spinal cord as well. So ideally, we want to keep their MAP, their mean arterial pressure, higher than normal, at least 85 millimeters of mercury. So again, this is higher than even a normal pressure would typically be for some of these patients. But we do this either through fluid resuscitation or we do this through norepinephrine support. And that typically is enough in a neurogenic shock picture to get them to this 85 millimeters of mercury level. So after that window has passed, so after that first week, that window for secondary neurologic injury is kind of clear now at this point, then long-term blood pressure management support is typically done through oral alpha agonists, such as mitogen would be a good example of that. So then lastly, we want to talk about anaphylactic shock. And this is, again, same kind of category. We're going to have that drop in SVR, that dilation of the vascular network, and cause a blood pressure droppage from that standpoint. Now, what causes this in anaphylactic shock is it results from a systemic hypersensitivity reaction, which is mediated by immunoglobulin E, so IgE. And what this does is it involves multiple organs throughout the body. And we have signs and symptoms such as angioedema develop, pruritus develop, hives, wheezing, upper airway obstruction. You have hypotension then that leads to this shock picture. And it's all due to this basophil and mast cell degranulation and a histamine release from a large systemic standpoint. And this is all the result from this reaction to some foreign object or foreign antigen that is causing this response. And this can be anything from medications to different material. And depending on what the patient's allergy list is, if they do have this anaphylactic response, you can see here why we do not want to present any of this in the operating room. Typically, some of the medications that we would see are even neuromuscular blocking agents that we would use can cause this, and latex can cause this as well. And so what we would do in this case, from a blood pressure standpoint, the capillaries are going to dilate and they're going to leak fluid, which causes a decreased intravascular volume. That's why this is considered in the distributive shock group here. Now, how we treat this is that we will give, obviously stop the triggering agent right away. That's the first thing we're going to do. And immediately we're going to treat with epinephrine. And the reason we do epinephrine for this shock and not the others is because it will also affect the beta 2 receptors in the bronchioles. And so it'll cause bronchodilation to help with that airway obstruction, as well as target alpha 1 receptors, which causes the vasoconstriction. And so this basically, epinephrine will handle most of, if not all, the different points that we need to address in the adrenergic receptor group. We're also going to give IV fluid administration, give antihistamines, corticosteroids, and you can also give albuterol to help with that bronchodilation as well. So again, you want to stop the triggering agent right away, treat with epinephrine, and then minimize the immune system response by giving antihistamines, corticosteroids, etc. So I know we kind of breezed through a lot of these different pictures, and we could have obviously gone into a lot more detail on each one, but we really wanted to do an overview of going through, first of all, hypotension, that it's common to see in the operating room. What are the normal responses that we're going to do, the normal interventions to that? And then when you have patients come in with a different shock bite picture, these are the different forms that you can have. And hopefully you saw here that it's not a one path highway to treat shock in general. This is very much dependent on which cause of shock is occurring. Again, if you have anybody from cardiogenic shock to neurogenic shock to anaphylactic shock, you're going to see how the treatment is going to vary significantly. And so while our goal is to restore that oxygenation to the tissues, it's very important that the critical thinking is there in order to determine the cause of this shock-like picture in order to appropriately treat these patients.